Well, good evening and welcome. All those that are finishing their dinner are going to miss out, right? It is wonderful to see so many familiar faces. We welcome you. This is the 20th year that we have had the Missionary Medicine Seminar. And I think that is a testimony to God's grace on this whole ministry and all the hospitals. We now, if I heard Dick Furman right yesterday, we now have 44 hospitals around the world that World Medical Mission is actively sending people to. And each year, the number of physicians that go out to hospitals around the world continues to increase. So we thank God for that. We thank you for coming to this weekend. We pray that you are going to be rejuvenated this weekend here at the Cove. With a wonderful opportunity to have some wonderful friendship with old friends and those that you may have worked with out on the field, kind of renew yourselves, get away from a busy practice, and have an opportunity to have maybe some well-deserved rest and some wonderful food here at the Cove. This year, we are going to kind of be focusing in two primary areas. One, as we commonly do, how the types of diseases that you might encounter out on the field. Again, we can't cover everything in one basically 24-hour course, but it is additive, which means you have to come back each year, right? So that you can continue to pick up new skills and new knowledge. So we're going to focus again, as we have for many years, talking about how to work in a mission hospital. But we're also having a number of lectures this year talking about disaster relief. So much of what Samaritan's Purse is doing now, and other groups as well, has to do with the tremendous areas of suffering that we hear about on the news every single day. And we're going to be hearing some late-breaking news straight out of Haiti. Elliot Tenpenny is going to be filling in not only his lecture, but also Lance Plyler's lecture, because Lance is currently in Haiti with one of the DART teams, helping with Samaritan's Purse's efforts there. So many people there in Haiti are really suffering because of the devastation from Hurricane Matthew. And so we actually just included a late-breaking picture that you'll get to see in just a little bit of the efforts that are going on down there. If you didn't pick up these two pieces of paper, conveniently yellow and blue, when you registered, there are some spares over here on the counter. These you need to be able to get your CME and CEU credit. It's the same form, whether you are a physician or nurse or any of the allied health specialties. Please fill out the yellow one and indicate that what lectures you attended, so that we can have a record of you being here, and so that we can send you your CME and CEU certificate. Each year we get emails, usually about 2 days before your licensure is due, if we're lucky. Frequently it's the day before, saying, "I never got my certificate." Well, that's usually because we didn't get one of these. So please make sure you fill these in, and it's really beneficial if you can drop them off in the basket that we'll have there on the counter. Certainly by Saturday night. I realize some people hand them in as they're rushing out the door on Sunday, but it would be great if we can get those ahead of time so that we can make sure that you get your CME and CEU certificates. Give us a couple of weeks to get those done, but we will be mailing those to you as we have in years past. The blue one, probably less important for you all, but it's more important for me, and that is your course evaluation. And we really do pay very close attention to these. We want your feedback. We want your suggestions for speakers. We take a close look at these every year as we're designing the course to come. Please print legibly. I know we all take that course in medical school or nursing school about how to chicken scratch so nobody can read it. Probably docs more than nurses. But please print legibly so that we can actually read your address. So that we can make sure that you're actually mailing it to the right home. I was given a note on a fairly somber note, actually. some of you may know Carl and Susan Zuberg. They were en route here to the Cove when they were apparently told that their grandson had unexpectedly passed away, and they had to turn around and head back home. So we do want to be lifting them up in prayer. I know that they would appreciate that during what is obviously a very difficult time for their family. Well, let's go ahead and get started. It is a real pleasure to be able to have all of our speakers, but Dick Bransford is well known to, I think, many of us in the room. Dick and Millie really spent their life out on the mission field, and Dick is going to be speaking with us tonight, kind of starting us off by some reflections of his career and his time with Millie out there and their kids in Africa. I had the opportunity this past spring to actually get to work with Dick for several days while we were in Ecuador together with the field hospital, and it was really a true joy and to be able to do that and to learn from him. Dick received his medical degree from Johns Hopkins, did his general surgery training at the University of Nebraska, then completed training in tropical medicine before going out onto the field in 1976 served at a number of different hospitals, as he'll outline in his talk with us tonight. Spent a great deal of time at Kajabi Hospital in Kenya, founded Bethany Crippled Children's Center, which then became Bethany Kids, continues to serve God out on the field in various capacities. As I said, recently served with the DART team in Ecuador. So, Dick, why don't you come on up? He's going to be speaking to us on reflections on a career in medical missions.
Thank you. My wife usually tells me, don't preach, tell stories. And so I think you're going to be more the recipients of stories. Mike gave me the topic of reflections, and I thought it was it made me really go back and reflect on life and what God had done in us. And I'm going to see if I can get this. I asked myself, what message might I want for you? And many of you whom I know, I thought to myself, we need more short and long-term missionaries on the field. We need more means of touching physical lives of men, women, and children. We need more people to care for the disabled, and that's my little niche in life for the last 25 years. But much more than that, we need more voices and bodies to reach the world for Jesus Christ. And I think we who are involved in medicine, whether it be nurses or physicians or what have you, have a tremendous niche that opens doors into places that other people might never get into. What does a general surgeon like me, who has worked with disabled kids for a while, ponder when he awakes at night, either in America or Kenya or into a North African country where I go more often? First, let me present to you a song that comes to my mind when I awake at night. And this is, I won't sing it for you because then you'd really be disappointed, but make me a servant, make me a servant. Humble and meek, Lord, let me lift up those who are weak, and may the prayer of my heart always be, make me a servant, make me a servant, make me a servant today. And I think that's the role we want. Sometimes physicians, particularly if you see them on television shows, seem to have less of a servant attitude and more of an actor's attitude. In North Africa, where I now go most often, I recognize that there are no Christians. When we first went there in 2006, we were told by the leaders of the organization I worked with, they said, there's not one known Christian in that country, either national or expat. And I thought to myself, that's peculiar. I'm not sure I believe them, to be absolutely honest with you. In 2006, we went there. The second day we were there, I was in an operating room, and a young lady came up behind me, a medical student, and she commented, I've never met a Christian. And those words hang in my mind ever since that time. I've never met a Christian. My thoughts often goes to John 3:16, where it says something about perishing. People will perish without a relationship with Jesus Christ. There are 15, 20 million people in that area, all of whom have very little access to medical care. When I look at this environment, having worked mostly with children with hydrocephalus or spina bifida, I look at the amount of neurosurgeons. There's 92 neurosurgeons in 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. 19 of the countries have no neurosurgeon. My niche for the last several years has been working with neurosurgical children. And simplistically said, as I look at those 92 neurosurgeons in 42 countries, and I recognize that there are projected to be 184,000 new cases of hydrocephalus every year, my conclusions as I added it all up, each neurosurgeon, if they were only doing kids with hydrocephalus, needed to do 2,000 operations a year. Or if they took Saturday and Sunday off, they could do 7 2/3 operations each day. If we add to that the children who are born with spina bifida and club feet and cleft lips and burn contractures and hypospadias and many other things, it's a huge challenge. Today, as we were making our way here, I get a text on WhatsApp and then a phone call from a girl in that North African country who's one of the young doctors sharing with me about a newborn with spina bifida and hydrocephalus and what can we do and what can she do at this time. What do we do? What does a guy like me who's now 76 years old do to approach this? Who considers, and I had a number of years ago, somebody presented to me the concept of state of the art. I like that concept. I've been living in Africa for about 20 years at the time, and it sounded very fancy and something I wanted to use a little bit more often. And I think it's a great concept for the West, but I think the other thing we have to ask ourselves, what about state of the need? What do we do with 184,000 new children with hydrocephalus every year? What do we do as American surgeons or American doctors who say, well, these ought to be sent to a specialist? And, you know, I had two areas of the body that were kind of sacrosanct to me as a medical student. One was the brain, one was the heart, and I never wanted to get in contact with them. But those were areas that need to be approached. It really doesn't require a particularly brilliant surgeon or person to put on a shunt. Don't tell the neurosurgeons that. I don't know if there's any neurosurgeons here. Or to perform many of the other procedures that I do. I'm a walking testimony of that premise. But God is primarily looking for people that will trust him and be obedient to him. So that's a little bit of an end of an introduction. Reflections on a career in missionary medicine. I broke down the word. First one was reflections, and there's a whole bunch of words there, but the ones that come to mind to me are quiet thought, pondering, thoughtful remembering, and there are several other ones. A career, a job or a profession that someone does for a long time. In today's world, we sometimes ask ourselves what a long time is. Medical missions, a medical practice, usually abroad in a different culture. But not really. Could be in Memphis, could be in the inner city, could be on an Indian reservation, or could be in many other places. This presentation is kind of a personal synthesis of what my life has been, a little bit of an evaluation of who I am and why I am like that. Meant to try to analyze some of the actions and conditions that came into my life that made me who I am. And I think I'd really project to you, as you look back on your life, what has made you who you are and what you've done. And we can either look at that uncomfortably. It's likely easier to accept such a pathway if you're looking at it retrospectively, if you realize that God is in control and he's in the control of history, and he's in the control of our lives, and he loves us passionately. I've often looked back and said it's welcome, and if we welcome the participation of God in our lives, we can look back and look at things that look like mistakes in our lives that really came out for our good. One of the things that I looked at one point in life was the die. The die has been cast, as an expression I heard, a tool that shapes a material or an object, or maybe a person. When I was 13, a cousin introduced me to the thought of reading one chapter of the Bible a day. I liked the idea. It sounded holy. Shortly thereafter, I was selling Christmas cards door to door, and a lady introduced me to the concept of a personal God who was interested in me. Shortly thereafter that, I wound up in a little church. A big Sunday was probably 100 people. And I found myself at the altar committing my lives to Jesus Christ. And within a year, by the time I was 14, as this slide says, I wanted to be a doctor. I had no doctors in my family. I had a distant cousin that was a nurse, but that was it. I wanted to be a doctor, a missionary, and an effective Christian. And for me, that die was cast then. I went on to high school. I went to a place called Compton High School. Now, a few months ago, you may have seen a movie called Straight Outta Compton. Not a very good movie. Bad rap. That's where I was raised. I went from there to UCLA and then on to medical school, as Mike said, at Hopkins. Became a doctor, became a surgeon, a missionary, and then hopefully somewhat of an effective Christian. Add to that marrying my bride in 51 years ago. That's what we used to look like. In case you... And it was a good match. We met in June of one year at InterVarsity's missionary camp, and by June of the next year we were married. We went on into the Air Force. And then this picture was taken when I was in my first year in the Air Force, getting ready to go out as a missionary. Down in the bottom is 1 Peter 2:9. It should be 2:9 and 10. But you were a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you've received mercy. And that's meant for each one of us. Each one of us. In whatever role we have in life, that's meant for us. I was not a real student of David Livingstone at that time, but this was some quotes that he made that made me pay attention. God, send me anywhere, only go with me. Lay any burden on me, only sustain me, and sever any tie in my heart except the tie that binds my heart to yours. When I went on what I think was the first DART team to Mogadishu in 1993, one of the things that we used to say to the American soldiers there is that there's no safer place to be than in the center of God's will. And I would... wandering down a street one day with two soldiers, both with flak jackets and helmets and things, and we walked down, and then the other person, Dr. Bill Barnett, was my mentor, and we walked down in t-shirts, and the soldiers were laughing that we had we were there comfortably while they were there in their outfits. Reflections. Words continue to come to mind when I reflect, lingering, mulling over time, devotions, memories. Could it be reflecting in some ways in my concept of God's interest in me that my life and the life of my family are somehow special to God and God is orchestrating them? I have a little note in my notes saying, is that arrogant? I hope not. I think God really does hopefully design our lives. There were struggles. There was school and broken relationships and failure and erratic timeline. Add to that a variety of relationships that eventually led to marriage. Children, five children, two adopted children in addition to that, 17 grandchildren and medical school and a variety of other things, but God was faithful and God did some wonderful things in our lives. From 1966 to 1975, I'm just going to give you a quick tour. 1966, Millie and I went to Kajabi. I was a medical student. She was a teacher. We spent our first anniversary in London on the way to Kajabi. I used to tell other medical students, I took my wife to London for our first anniversary. They were very impressed, except it was just a layover by British Airways. 1972, I had finished my residency. We went back to Kajabi for 2 months, Kapsawar for a month, and then on to Nyankunde in the Democratic Republic of Congo. At that time, we had two kids. We were there for 5 months before I went into the Air Force as one of the final draftees. 1975, we returned to Switzerland and to study French in preparation for going to Congo or this Indian Ocean island. We went on from there to Belgium, studied tropical medicine, had a great time. In 1976, we went to Congo. I did not want to go to Congo. My wife kept saying to me, "You're under authority." I didn't appreciate that at that time, but it was an interesting thought. And we went there, and I didn't sleep well. It was the first time in my life I think I didn't sleep well. Finally, we went and met with the church council. They asked us a number of questions and said, "Why don't we send you to those Indian Ocean islands as our missionaries?" So my wife knew far more than I did. I hate to tell that in front of her, but anyhow, she knew more than I did. And we went there as representatives of the Church of Congo. In 1976 and 77, we were on this Indian Ocean island, and I was the chief of surgery and the chief of obstetrics. Now, that sounds very auspicious, but in reality, I was the only person doing any surgery on an island of 250,000, 300,000 people. We had a 350-bed hospital with two doctors, and we were an island that was essentially 100% Muslim. During our year there, the volcano exploded, our government collapsed, and a lot of things, but God was faithful. God kept us there. In 1977, we went across to Kajabi in Kenya to have our baby, only to be surprised, and this was long before ultrasound, that we had twins. And the fourth child that Millie wanted to have after we got to Africa became our fourth and fifth child. Good things. Shortly thereafter, after being on the Indian Ocean island, things didn't do so well. I got tick typhus, lost a lot of weight, and we went temporarily and then permanently to Kajabi, where we spent the next 34 years. Kajabi was our base. Then it became disabled children. 1982, we made a visit to what was called Kajiado Child Care Center. There were about 75 children, all Maasai, nearly all with polio. They brought us into the room that you can see there. This was after giving us a tour. We went into the preschool room. There were crutches all over the floor and braces in all their legs. And this Scottish nurse said to me, "Can you help us?" And I said, as an arrogant surgeon, "I'll try." I'd never even seen an operation on polio, but we decided to try. We began dreaming of not only caring for disabled children in Kenya, but maybe throughout Africa and maybe beyond Africa. And it was the biggest blessing of my life. It was not something I would have never delved into, but became a blessing for me. Looking on from there, in 1992, Joshua, our number six child, was brought into the hospital with a fractured skull, hypothermia, pneumonia. And one day I called. He was better, but he was abandoned. He'd been thrown over the side of a hill. And I said, could my daughter come down and take care of him for the day? Because the nurses were just too busy. And she came down, took him up to the house. And as the afternoon came, I said, "You better take him back to the pediatric ward." And it's like a puppy. My daughter says, "Can't we just keep him here tonight?" So we explored and found a few diapers and a bottle. And we kept him there for a night, another night, another night. And That's been 24 years ago, and we're still keeping him. So it was an interesting venture. And then in 1992 and 1993, there was a famine in Somalia. And one daughter went up to Somalia, and she fed starving children all day while I saw patients. And then I went on over into Mogadishu and worked with them for a while. That was my first taste of war like that. 1994, we sat in our home listening to about Rwanda and the genocide. And again, my daughter, who was then a nursing student, said, "Dad, we ought to go." And so shortly thereafter, we joined Mel and Sylvia Cheatham and flew into Uganda and made our way across the border. And I don't know if they would tell you this, but I still remember driving in that car for about an hour and not seeing one living person or one living thing even until we crossed a bridge with the army. We drove on, wound up coming into this camp with about 100,000 people. And it was a very interesting and traumatic and wonderful experience. Left my daughter there. She lost several children in her tent, but she never forgot that. She never forgot that. In 1996 through 2001, I wound up in Sudan intermittently helping. Our first trip in, I went with Calvary Chapel, and the picture down in the left-hand lower border is my two daughters who went with me, and a little girl that was 10 months old and weighed 8 pounds, Faith. And we brought her out of Sudan. She lived in our home about 3 months and was adopted by some other friends. 1996, a little bit later in the year, we wound up going to a home for abandoned children. And they had a little boy named Philip there. Philip was obviously behind. Philip had a shunt put in for meningitis and hydrocephalus, and they said, "Philip needs a home." And so at 56, we took a new baby home who turns 21 today. He's in college. Why do I tell you all these things? I don't have a good idea, but I just like to share you what makes me who I am. And 1998, we opened what was called the Bethany Crippled Children's Center, which is now the Cure International Children's Hospital, mostly orthopedic rehab, and we were mostly doing polio and club feet at that time. Soon thereafter, we started getting children with hydrocephalus coming. And they grew so much that in 2004, to give you a sanitary appearance, it seemed best to take our children across the street to Kajabi Hospital and begin what was known as Bethany Kids at Kajabi Hospital. This is what happened. If you look at the red line, that is shunt procedures. In 1997, we did 7 shunt procedures. In 2011, we did over 900 shunt procedures. In 1997, we did 9 closures of the back for children with spina bifida, and later we did nearly 400 children with spina bifida. The work grew, my passion for these kids grew, and our results improved remarkably. 2006, we began going to what I call a creative access country, a North African country. The young lady on the left is the one that called me today. At the time we first went there, she was a medical student. And she and another medical student came along and said, "Can we help you?" Well, we were totally out of our element. We didn't speak the language. We didn't know the system of the hospital, but she came alongside and helped us. And she continues to help us. She's now a married young woman with a child about 2.5 years old. We kept going back from 2006. This is our 10th year. This is the place that the lady came up behind me and said, "I've never met a Christian." We were a presence. The man in the middle picture up above is my son, who's now an orthopedic surgeon. We were teaching, and according to Scripture, digging and watering and pruning. We want to remember Anissa down in the On the left side is a young lady who came to me. She had burned herself and had terrible burns. She says, I only want to feed myself. And that's where we began. 2006 to 2016, that was where we were and continue to go. I continue to go there. The work with the disabled was a tremendously needy area for us. But what are the fruit? What are the fruit? This is Mercy. This is our chaplain for Bethany Kids at Kajabi Hospital. And Mercy came to work with us in 2005. And she said shortly thereafter, she says, Dick, could we have some disciplers? And I said, Mercy, what's a discipler? And she says, we want people to follow up our new believers in the village and to follow up our sick people and get them back to clinic. I said, sure. Well, Mercy now has 500 volunteer disciplers. And in 2009, we saw about 800 people come to the Lord. And according to her, 2010, about 5,000. 2011, about 7,000. Now, those are not exact. But over a 10-year period, she estimates we've seen 38,000 people come to the Lord. One year I did the facetious thing of, let's see how much our budget for spiritual ministry was, and let's see how many people came to the Lord. Figured it cost us $3.84 for each person that came to the Lord. Now, don't go out and tell everybody that, because I'm sure those numbers are a little off. Anyhow, there was... ultimately, retirement came in 2011, or semi-retirement, my wife would say, and there was an anxious contentment. A mixed bag of a surgical career. My life began on the islands as a general surgeon, and then it converted to C-sections, hysterectomies, prostatectomies, orthopedic procedures, and a whole variety of other things. How do I keep myself out of trouble? Well, I looked at that and I said, while trying to do a good job, I just did my best and trusted the Lord and looked for ways in which we could improve things. Due to a lack of specialists and a lack of access and a lack of funds, many people can't find their way to surgical care. But we could work on it. 20 and 30 and 40 years ago, they couldn't find their way to surgical care, and even today. My approach was just to do my best, to do a lot of reading, to take a lot of books, and sometimes good books with pictures in it. Surgeons aren't supposed to be able to read, but they can tell what pictures look like. And I occasionally would take them into the operating room and put them there and ask the nurse to turn the page. And that worked for a while. Dr. Carter, Lewis Carter, I don't know if Lewis is here or not, tried to teach me how to do a maxillectomy, and I read that enough that I realized I couldn't. Did I have any privileges? Yeah, I had a lot of privileges in this. In the Indian Ocean Island, I worked from 7 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon and then got emergencies every afternoon. And they would call me, and they'd say, there's a fish hook in the ear, and I said, you guys can take care of this. And he says, no, come see. Fish hook was like this. I had to go home and get my vice grips and my hacksaw to get it out of the ear. They said, a fish bit this guy. I said, you can take care of this, but they didn't tell me they bit him like this. But the most common thing was fractures, and I'd often turn to my kids, and I'd say, would you like to go with me? And they'd say, yeah. And so Bethany, who was 3 then, would go down and help me smooth plaster after fractures, falling out of the mango tree. Another privilege was taking my kids on surgical trips. The school would let me take them out. Taking my son to Zanzibar to do polio operations. Taking Bethany up to Somalia area and taking care of them, a whole bunch of things. And it was a privilege. And one of the things that was a privilege was at some days I'd walk into the operating room and I'd say, I have an emergency at 3:30 this afternoon. And everybody would look at me and smile because they knew my kids were playing ball that time. And we work really hard and I pick up the mop and mop in the operating room and it worked well. How are you going to keep your balance? How are you going to keep your balance if you do something like this? Well, one is you're having devotions, and that was indoctrinated in me soon. Alone and together and with anybody that's visiting in your home. Prayer, personal and groups and with your family. My twins, when they were in first grade, used to take prayer requests up to the first grade. Our teacher, Miss Cook, had in the back of the door prayers and answered prayers, and they taught them. And I would, especially, I was doing esophagectomies then. I never lost an esophagectomy, at least not when we did the case. Books that you can read, books that you can read with your kids. Don't get those silly books that you don't like to read. You want to read something with your kids. And you just come back to yourself and say, who owns all my gifts? Who has given me these privileges? All of them have been given to us by God. I'm just going to skip through a few of these. These are the privileges. Devotions, prayer, and books. And I'd come down to the end and I'd say, I'd do it all over again in a minute. And I'd take you on. My rewards, these are my kids. These are my grandkids. Can you imagine having that many kids? These are my kids. I can tell you the names of nearly every one of them. Peter and Lucy and what's her name? Daisy and Michael and Anissa. These were my kids. Some of them are dead. And these are the ones with whom I work. The ones on the right, the two on the outside, both have spina bifida. One's a nurse and one's a social worker. And the one in the middle had another urologic problem. The couple on the left, she's probably the first girl in Kenya that's ever had a baby as a person with spina bifida. And I just like to say it's a great life. If you haven't been abroad, do it. Do it. It's a privilege to do what God has led us to do. Thank you.